Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you late on Roberta's Pizzeria, the Heritage Radio Network in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Calling your questions to 718-497, what is it, 497? 2128?
That's, you got it.
718-497-2128. We are so late, in fact, that I'm going to have to, while I'm calling up the stuff, we can have some of the niceties, but we have no time for the normal niceties.
We can't be nice today.
No niceties.
But we do have a caller who's been patiently waiting.
Oh, geez. Caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave, it's Michael Nyken.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
All righty.
I hear you're running late today.
Yes, I am. But I'm sure you know that well enough to call in late and only have to wait a couple of minutes.
Right, I've got the whole schedule figured out. No problem.
Sweet.
So what's up? I just wanted to let you know. I just got this cocktail book. I don't know if you heard about it yet. It's called Liquid Intelligence.
Oh, I have heard of that. I hear it's terrible. Okay, I'm
learning a lot from this book. It's fantastic.
Yeah, there are, as I think you point out, a couple other people, there are a couple of typos in it that we're going to fix for the next printing. There's just so many
typos happen.
There's so many data points in it that. You know, for those of you that are listening, like one of the Manhattan recipes, I think, Michael, you might have pointed this out along with a couple other people, like a one just got dropped, so it says a fat 3/4 of vermouth instead of 1 3/4, right? Is that you that pointed that out?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
I did notice that, but you know what? My book has a million errors, and you wouldn't believe the errata section for modern cuisine, so, you know, don't forget that.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, we had a weird thing where when they did the layout on one of the charts, like a bunch of the acid percentages got switched into just weird numbers. But don't worry, people.
No.
We'll get it all fixed.
No. But despite all that, forget little details, man. This is a great book. I'm really, really enjoying it. I'm learning so much about, like, the details of how things chill and different kinds of textures and the different acid ratios and everything. Like I've always been a kind of a seat-of-the-pants cocktail maker, and I can see this is going to up my game considerably.
Nice. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, just wanted to say that because I'm really looking forward to working my way through the whole thing.
All right, sweet. And you know, one of the things in the book that address in the future is that currently our lime clarification technique that I use, you know, you wouldn't use it at home. You wouldn't use it if you didn't have a centrifuge, or if you had a really good centrifuge, like, you know, when I say good, I mean, you know, upwards of 40,000 G's or something like this. You know, you could clarify lime juice without any of the clarification aids that I use. But I think one of the things for research, maybe you can look into it, is this fungal chitosan. Because the one thing that we use that's not vegetarian is this chitosan, which is derived from shrimp cells. It's non-allergenic. I'm not worried about it from a seafood allergy standpoint. And it is spun out, so it's not in the product that people are consuming, but it is a processing aid that we're using that's of animal origin, and I'd like to be able to get rid of it. So that's like one of the – that's, you know, because I think I might mention somewhere – I can't remember because it's a long book, but and I've said it on the air many times, is that I think it's entirely fair for, you know, a vegetarian to assume that they can not worry about the cocktail menu unless it obviously states something of animal origin, you know?
Right. Although, isn't that the case with some wine finding agents too?
Oh yeah, but the issue with wine finding agents is that no one tells you what they're using. So, you know, chitosan is used as a wine finding agent.
Right.
You know,
I've always put this in the category of things I'm not going to worry about too much. But you're right; I probably wouldn't use it myself. So.
Right. That's the thing. So there's it's like I've always said, like everyone's drawing a line, right? I mean, you pay taxes to people that eat meat all the time. We pay tax. I'm sure like many of the people that, you know, we hire in the government are, you know, not just meat eaters, but like actual bad people, like, you know, torturers, murderers of people, like, you know, mutilators of animals, all kinds of horrible stuff. So it's like a question of like, it's a question of where's the line, you know what I mean? And like what, but you know, I think it's always good to push, I think it's always good to push as far as you can in a direction You always learn. The more you push, the more you learn.
That makes sense to me. So do you have any ideas of things that can be used instead of ketocin for the lime?
Well, there is in the EU, there is a fungally derived ketocin, and we got a sample of it at the bar, but it was one of those things where I didn't have time to run the test myself, and it fell through the cracks. Like, no one was able to come up with a good protocol for it. It comes in powdered form, and, you know, everyone was used to using the solution, the ketocin solution. So, you know, I don't know that it's, you know, fully available here in the U.S., but there's no reason why ketocin can't be fungally produced. And I think that, you know, with the increasing number of people that want, you know, full disclosure of the processing aids that are used in things, that you'll see more of a switch towards it. Because I think just in general, regardless of anything, people are like, shrimp shells. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, and that latest Lucky Peach pointed out the shrimp industry is a royal mess. So, you know, getting away from that would be good anyhow.
Oh, were they talking about the slavery in Thailand?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, you know, that first came to my attention, I don't know, a couple of months ago. And I was like, I can't believe it. I can't believe it, you know?
It's disgusting.
Yeah. Well, it just goes to show, the more you investigate, the worse things are in general, right?
This is true. Sometimes you don't want to know.
Yeah.
Does the clarified lime juice freeze well?
No. No.
What about in a cryogenic freeze?
No. Oh, I've never tried. Like actually completely immobilize it, like subeutectic freezing?
Wow. Yeah, we have a ridiculous freezer here.
Why don't you try it and tell me?
Okay. We'll do it. We got a big bad centrifuge and a nice freezer. So yeah, I'll give that a shot.
I would freeze it as rapidly as possible so you don't have increased concentration effects as it's freezing down.
Right. If we put stuff flat in a bag and throw it in that freezer, man, it freezes very rapidly.
Yeah, let me know. So what I typically do, I've just started doing it with the leftover clary lime because we have a lot of it, is I sugar it and heat it with a little lime peel and turn it into a cordial. And then it's delicious.
Oh, that sounds good too.
Yeah, and so it's a cordial that like is already clarified, and so you can use it in stirred drinks for a cordial flavor, and it's quite good because once you heat it, and once you take old lime juice with sugar and you heat it, then it goes from being that awful old lime juice to being something different. You know?
Right. That makes sense. Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I don't want to take up your whole show, but great talking to you. Congrats on the book, man.
Thanks a lot. Hope next time you're out on this coast, stop by and see us.
I would never miss a chance.
All right,
take care.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
So we do have one more caller that was waiting patiently.
All right, sweet. Caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave, it's Hugo from Silver Spring, Maryland. How are you?
Hey, doing all right. What's up?
Well, first of all, I want to, just echo the last caller. Book is fantastic. Went through it pretty quickly. Just a wealth of information there. And it was just, I think one of the things that surprised me the most was just how well, your voice, which I know from the radio show, came through just amazingly through the book. Like I found myself bursting out laughing in different sections. So
hopefully it wasn't a serious section. Hopefully it wasn't like the section where you were laughing at how like poorly the recipe was going. But
some of that. But one complaint that I do have is that you really did tease us with the red hot poker, and then you're like, "Well, I'm not going to tell you how to do it."
Well, I mean, look. I mean, the issue with the. I mean. I can tell anyone how to make it. I don't have it at my fingertips right now, but I'm never going to sell them. So,
right,
I have no problem telling people how they're made, except for it's, inherently, if you can weld, and if you can, purchase stuff with a credit card off McMaster Car, you can buy everything that you need for it. You can buy on McMaster Car's website. I just
figured it was some crazy legal liability to put those instructions in the book as well.
Well, and I mean, there's it's already 100,000 words as it is, and I don't pull any punches on it. So like, if I was going to go into like a full detail, there'd be I'd have to tell you what to look out for when you're welding, what wattages to look out for, issues I have with different kind of cartridge heaters. Because it's basically just a high temperature cartridge heater, and I've tried, many dozens of different wattages and lengths and diameters, and I've come up with the one that, can run you know, without blowing itself out in the open air, because anytime you use a heater that's powerful enough to burn itself out and try to control it, the control invariably fails with all the thermal cycling. And when the control fails, it always fails in the direction of getting too hot, and then the thing burns out, sometimes spectacularly. So, I can give all this stuff, but then also you got to insulate it right when you're wrapping it. You got to weld it right, grind it down. I mean, none of it's rocket science, you know. Back when Piper.
But it's a lot more work than you kind of mentioned in the book, so we can leave it at that, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, again, if someone wants it, you know, like next week, if you put the question in or whatever, I can give you the part numbers. And in fact, I'm going to be making a batch. You know, someone stole our welder, and as soon as we get a welder back in the shop, I'm gonna have to make a batch for this year's Red Hot Pokers. Maybe I'll take some pictures of the process.
That'd be cool. So I had some actual questions, though, on a couple of things. I was going to ask, similarly about the chitosan. I do keep kosher, so, you mentioned the fungal in the book, but I heard your answer, so it seems like there's really not a good alternative at this point. What I was just thinking right now is that I would reach out to maybe some kosher winemakers and see what they use for wine finding agents.
Yeah.
Come up with that. The other thing, for the clarified grapefruit juice, I bought a home carbonation rig. I'm going to be making the gin and juice this weekend. How long? I know you mentioned with the lime juice, it doesn't really keep very well. You find the same thing with the grapefruit juice as well?
No,
what would you say
no.
Is like the maximum clarified storage time?
Yeah, clarified grapefruit juice keeps fairly well. So I think you a couple of days is not going to be a problem.
Okay.
Are you going to do agar or freeze thaw?
Agar.
Okay. I mean, but agar. What I meant is quick agar or freeze thaw.
Well, which would you recommend? I could do either one.
If you're going to use it right away, you can do quick, but Nastasia hates doing the quick, right?
Yes.
She hates it. It's like one of the things that she refuses to ever do again. Mm-hmm. If you're practiced with quick, the good thing about quick is it's quick. I typically reserve quick clarification for things like lime and lemon that can't sit around, or if I only need a small amount. Like if you only need half a liter, then, quick is fine. And because if you lose 250 mils, it's not a big deal. If you're trying to make like 2 gallons of it, you know what I mean? Then quick agar becomes a little bit of a pain in the butt. And then I would move to freeze thaw. With freeze thaw, you're going to have, probably a higher yield, less overall work time, even though it takes longer to do. There was another. Oh yes, and the quick one will eventually. Well, the next day will throw a cloud off. So usually, if you're going to do quick, do it the day you're going to use it. You know what I mean? You can you can resettle out the cloud, but there will be some agar that's left in the liquid that'll then kind of stick together overnight to form kind of cloudiness. So, I would say but remember the freeze thaw takes a couple of days, so you have to start soon.
Okay, yeah, no, because I was doing for a dinner on Sunday, so actually now it sounds like the freeze thaw is a better method.
Yeah.
If I can ask you one more question, you had a little sidebar in there about eutectic freezing, and try as I might to understand the principle behind it, I actually asked my brother, who's a chemical engineer and brother-in-law also, and we weren't really sure what was going on there. I don't know if you can take a minute to kind of expound on that.
Sure. So there's a concentration for all salts in water where it kind of thaws like a unitary substance like water, right? And so it's the point at which the point at which that happens and the temperature at which that happens. So typically, when you're using a eutectic freezing plate, they'll choose the temperature of the plate based on the salts that they put into it, right? And then it freezes and thaws at that concentration. So if you have less salt, let's say, of whatever salt you're going to choose in your liquid, what will happen is you'll start crystallizing pure water out, right? You'll then kind of reach a eutectic solution, and then it'll start freezing as a solid there. I think that's how it'll work. And then it'll thaw out. Whereas if you start with the percentage, with that kind of magic percentage of of salts in it, it will stay liquid and then freeze at its at whatever its eutectic freezing temperature is, and then freeze solid. And then as it thaws, it will do the same at the same temperature. So there won't be any temperature drift during the freezing and thawing cycle. So it'll.
So it's all about the uniformity of the solution, kind of as it's freezing into one thing.
Right. So you, what you don't want to have happen is you don't want to. So normally, if you just use salt and ice, right? Eventually, as the salt as it starts diluting down, the temperature is going to start rising, right? Or conversely, right. Sometimes you know if the brine concentration increases because more salt dissolves into it, your temperature can drop. Is it like you know like there's like it can go either way. So by using this kind of like you know these magic ratios, you can have it act like a pure substance. Typically, the heat of fusion is not as great, I think. I'd have to look back. It's not as great as it would be in a pure water solution, but you still have that kind of constant temperature. And this is used commercially all the time for things like trucks, where they'll throw like large plates into a huge, you know, walk-in freezer for several days, and then throw the plates into a truck or into like a, you know, an ice cream cooler case, and then they'll go around and they can keep it, you know, at perfect dipping temperature or storage temperature, whatever they want.
I gotcha. Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
All right.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot, Dave.
All right, thank you. Hey, Jack, I know we only have 5 minutes.
Yeah, we can keep
minutes.
Going,
yeah. You want to do the – you want to – whoever's paid for this episode, you want them to put it up real quick?
What's that? Oh, we can keep going. We'll put the ad in later.
Oh, I like that. It's like to the live listeners. You're like, whatever. We'll put it in later.
Yeah.
We'll put it in later. Nice. By the way, Stas, you want to announce what's going to happen with Amazon later?
No, I don't really want to. No,
okay, because someone called in Quinn DuPont. I was supposed to talk about – searing techniques with the Searsol on the radio show. So, searing techniques with the Searsol. All right, I think, you know, in reading the reviews of people that are using it, I think the prime thing, if you think that it's too slow, right, you want to get the Searsol much closer to the surface of what you're doing. The exceptions are things that are dry, like breads, go from like kind of, you know, totally blonde, and they can start burning very quickly because there's not a lot of liquids to moderate it. So those things you have to be a little more careful with. And so typically breads I'll hold. What do you say this does? What is that, like 2.5 inches, 3 inches?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, about that far away. And I'll move it around. And you can actually, I mean, I shouldn't say this. You can actually like hold things and like manipulate. It's, you know, it's very, you don't have to kind of worry about it. But things like steaks, cheese also usually. Okay, I'll give you this because I'm going to have to go to another question. Here's what I usually do. I get it down fairly close, and I do tiny little circles, and I wait for it to start seeing sizzle or bubble or movement, and then I'll move away from it, and I'll start it in another zone. And by the time I start it getting bubbling in a second zone, I can start moving it back and forth like a welder, kind of creating a puddle, not like a puddle, but like kind of creating a zone of searing, just like a welder can when you're moving a MIG welder or an arc welder back and forth by, you know, melting the rod in and forming a puddle. And by doing that, you can keep a relatively large area in kind of fine searing fashion. So, and it's a lot more effective than like hitting and stopping and, you know, moving too quickly, for instance. So the general rule of thumb is that for something the size of like a rib steak, you're going to want to do about a minute and a half per side. Cheese, typically I'll go really close till it starts bubbling. I'll pull back a little bit, zip around. And let's say I'm doing like 5 burgers. I'll hit one really hard go, hit the next one, and then like start moving around until I'm moving around. And I'm constantly hitting each one for, you know, a couple of seconds until they're all cooked. You're going to get a better crust in terms of like tack, 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 tack crust on something by hitting it a couple times and letting it rest a little bit in between. So if you're doing like 3 or 4 steaks, it's a good idea to kind of not do one all the way to the finish and then do the next one all the way to finish, but keep them all little, you know, don't have them stop entirely, but hit and then come back to, you know, the same one at least twice. I find that's the kind of going to give the best crust. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. And I can give more, you know, more what to call it if anyone wants to know. Okay. Philippe Lament wrote in, your book is finally coming out. So stoked. Thank you. I have a sticky question for you. I'm trying to make an alcoholic ice cream for a Paco Jet. I want to retain the raw alcohol taste. I've been using cognac and Calvados. Do you like Calvados or Calvados? How do you pronounce it? So I was like, I don't care. I don't drink that stuff.
No.
Do you like that stuff?
I don't think I've ever had it.
No?
No.
You know the apple brandy?
Oh, yeah.
No.
I guess it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. She's like, they don't make it in Italy or Switzerland, so I don't drink it.
Oh.
I don't drink it. Do you have any suggestions on ratios or stabilizers I can use to have a nice consistency? Thank you. Okay. So what I would do is I would do what I always do when I want something to not – I mean, obviously, for those of you that, like, I don't know, you're zoning out because I'm speaking too quickly or whatever, the problem here is obviously you add too much liquor, you affect the texture. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. So you don't want to – like, one solution, which is the wrong solution, and you can't do it in a Paco Jet anyway, so it doesn't matter. I guess you could, is to freeze it much colder than you normally would in a Paco Jet. But that's not going to work because when alcoholic stuff melts out, it typically melts out in a weird way. So unlike typical sorbets that have relatively nice melt profile, over alcohol sorbets are like, they just blast out on you. You know what I mean? You've seen that happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not nice. So what I would do is cheat in the same way that I always cheat, and I would make a gel-an fluid gel with the alcohol. So I would make a portion of the sorbet base kind of normal and then create a gel-an fluid gel. I would say total sorbet, I would go in the ratio of like no more than 0.5%, and that will never melt. So you can spin it, and it'll stay like the texture of – I mean, it won't melt. It'll stay like the texture of just melted sorbet on the surface of the sorbet, but it'll hold its shape. So in other words, like whatever it is, whatever your liquid base is in it – don't forget the solids because my recipe doesn't work on that. But whatever the liquid base is, 0.5%. Remember, you're going to have to boil that, and then you can temper stuff into it, let it chill into, and then blend it into a fluid gel, and then spin it in the Paco Jet, and that should work. And it'll be super creamy. You might have to up your flavors a little bit because 0.5% of Calcogel FF, which is low acyl gelan, is quite a lot and will mask the flavor somewhat, but it'll be smooth and creamy. Right? Stas, you hate, do you like things that are smooth and creamy?
Yeah.
But you don't like when people describe them as smooth and creamy.
Come on, dude.
All right. Okay, got a story in from Ross in Aruba, and I wanted us to read this on the air. And I might have to read it quickly because, you know, I'm late. Thanks for your help. I look forward to getting the two Searsols. I hope you better already have them. He does. All right, good. As a home cook, I've been coming – and by the way, I like home cook. Cook. A lot of honor in cooking. Cook. As a home cook, I've become enthralled with sous vide cooking in an Innova circulator, low temperature, I'm sure. I'm amazed with its ease and convenience. At last, chicken, steaks, and other meats cooked to desired level of doneness. Yes, that is a word, by the way. Without fail. We've become so attached to sous vide cooking that we took the Innova circulator on a budget vacation to Aruba. Bought a $5 plastic bucket at a local grocery store, and we were cooking. We took Zippies with us because we weren't sure about their availability. By the way, were they available? Could you get the Ziplocs? And remember, people, don't buy the cheap Ziplocs because remember, Stas, we had that problem with the cheap Ziplocs? Do not buy it. Buy the freezer ones. The freezer ones. We were doing an event the other day, and they were leaking. Put your angry face on. Yeah. All right. Anyway, because we weren't sure about their availability, we had steaks that could compete with those available at Aruba's high-end restaurants. Before we went to the beach or bar, we'd pop the meat in the bags, and they'd be ready when we got back to our apartment. More importantly, if we wanted to do some more snorkeling or have another drink, we could. We didn't have to rush back and tend to the cooking, which is a good point. If you're snorkeling – by the way, I don't know about the safety of snorkeling and drinking. I'm sure you're drinking responsibly while you're snorkeling. But yes, definitely, you know, if you're under the water and, you know, looking around at all the awesome sea life and you lose track of time, a normal steak would be ruined, right? Right. Yeah. Anyway, we didn't have to rush back to tend to the cooking. The food stayed fine and didn't overcook in the circulator. Now we want to try the Searsol at home, not on vacation. Airline security folks may have qualms about such a device. Thank you for your help. Regards, Ross. Now listen, Ross, I bring the Searsol with me all the time on the airport. And occasionally people are like, what is this? And I go, it is a cooking device. And they're like, oh. But I unscrew it from the torch and I bring the torch separately. And they look at it a couple times to look at. I also bring Red Hot Pokers with me. I always bring those things. You can bring them in checked luggage, obviously, but then they're going to search your luggage. But I bring them in my carry-on because I never bring checked luggage to demos because I've had them not show up and then you don't have a demo. So I plan demos around being able to bring stuff in my carry-on. So you can do it. But good luck with the home use of Sears. I'll let us know how it works. And then how many minutes we got, Jack?
Under five.
Under five. Okay. All right. Let me hit this quick. Is next week Thanksgiving or the week after?
Week after.
Okay. So, Antoine, I'm going to get your brining question on birds because I'm assuming that's for Thanksgiving. I'm going to get that next week, as well as Lee Crawford's explanation of – by the way, wrote in about Julia Child and went back and watched her old black and white shows.
That was from Gene.
Oh, that was from Gene?
G-E-A-N-N-E. How do you say that?
Gene? Anyway, it's from Gene, not from Lee. Anyway, I went back and watched that episode, which is one of the reasons I'm a little bit late because I was doing research. Holy crap. You forget what a badass Julia Child is. You know what I mean? You forget and then you watch it. She might have been a little drunk. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that's like whatever. That's the stereo. You know, that's her that's her shtick. Like she did that way before Hoda and Kathy Lee. You know what I'm saying? Or I don't know, maybe the same time as Dean Martin did the kind of a little bit tipsy thing. You know what I mean? But such an intense badass. I'm gonna go back and now you've ruined me. I have to go back and read all those. So we'll get that. I'm gonna hit really quickly. Daniel from San Jose wrote about rose petals. I've been making candy rose petals the classic way by coating the rose petals in a thin layer of egg white, dipping them in sugar, and then leaving them out to dry. My problem is to be able to finely chop them for use in a plated dessert, but the egg white sugar always flakes apart from the dried rose petal when it's chopped. Is there any way I can modify the prep so I can drop the candy rose petals without them flaking apart? Thanks. I've never tried it, but the problem is you don't want to heat them. That's the issue. Johnny Zini used to do a thing where he would dip them in simple syrup and lay them out on a paper towel to dry after he dusted them with sugar. But I think the key is maybe let them half the egg white is going to be a problem because the proteins are gonna kind of crunch up on you. But I think if you let them go demi-sec, as they say, half dry, and then chop them, and then let them finish out after that. If you can stop them from the problem is they're gonna gum up. So you're going to have to sit there and individually chop each rose petal you can't even do a shift knot because you can't roll it. It'll stick, right? I don't know. It's problematic. But I don't know. I tried to think of a surefire way, but maybe try Johnny's way instead of with the egg white. Maybe it'll work. Now, as for other things I'm not going to get to in time, let me see. Uriel and your milk powder. He was talking about milk powder and Maillard for browning and meats. I'm going to get that later. And also Alex's bear. We didn't like our bear, but I'm going to research more about bear. If you have a young bear, then it's you're going to be better off. But I'll look more into cooking bear. The one time that we cooked bear, did you even taste it, Stas?
No, I don't think I tasted the bear. It is
terrible. But again, young bear is good. Also, David, with your lemon sorbet question, I'll catch next time because it's not a problem. I can do it. And I just have too many questions to answer. But I missed Ken Ingber's. Would you call it a diatribe?
Yeah.
All right. I think he would fairly call it a diatribe. So I'll read that really quickly, and then we can discuss it later if people have more questions on it. Okay. Dave and the Hammer by extension, if not conspiracy, have been champions of low temperature and sous vide cooking. When you started this campaign on the radio, this was still pretty exotic, requiring either relatively expensive equipment or internet hacks that only a small cadre of enthusiasts would employ. That has changed, not only because of the promotion of low temp and sous vide by us and others, but because sous vide supreme was successful in the mainstream, and the cost of an immersion circulator has come way down. I backed the Nomiku, which works well. I assume this is harsh. I assume Bam's venture, Bam is Wee Pop Soupy Pot, who, one of the founders of... I assume BAM's venture will not survive because since they've started, PolyScience has come down in price, and both the Sansar and Anova are better rated and available for $200. By the way, there's a new Nomiku coming out, so I don't play favorites in the circulator market because I'm friends with a lot of these folks, but don't count anyone out yet. And he goes, bad news for BAM, but great news for consumers. Ouch. An immersion circulator is now a little pricey for an impulse purchase, but clearly inexpensive enough to be a regular consumer product. But the information and education provided by cooking issues and the like are not as available as the products are. Take me as an example. I am not a typical consumer. I listen to cooking issues. I have books by McGee and Keller on my night table. On your night table. I'm going to tell Harold about that. And do plenty of research. Hell, I have even read a Hassett plan. Yet with all my attention and devotion, I understand the safety issues that are, I understand the safety issues that are so widely mentioned very poorly. For various reasons, mostly in abundance of caution, I've almost invariably prepared low-temperature meals by reaching pasteurization, and I use the quick-chill method for storing. But even I don't really understand this. If I am researching pasteurization temp and time, how could this be a big danger I keep hearing about? With conventional cooking, you leave food in pots while you eat, you leave it out on the counter to cool, and you put it in the fridge, all the while in the danger zone. If the contents of the low-temp bag are pasteurized, why isn't that close to canning? It's not close to canning. It's not, because you're not killing the spores. But anyway, why isn't that close to canning, giving me a much wider margin of safety than ordinary prepared food? It is, but you know, I'm not going to have time to discuss it, but it is. Anyway, if the bag's contents are pasteurized, I would find it plausible to conclude that it would be perfectly safe to throw it in the fridge without a quick chill ice bath. This was asked by someone on the air quite a while ago. Dave, in my opinion, did not catch the drift of the question and did not answer it. This came to a head when considering fish. Chefs promoted a combination salting in the danger zone and cooking for salmon that was declared safe. Chris Young did a challenge test on it, which is how they figured out it was safe. Fine for that specific chef step preparation, but you see plenty of examples of cooking fish well below 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Even the amusing hot water tap method. I don't want to cook all fish to pasteurization all the time. In fact, I never do. Me, personally, Dave. And I want to experiment with textures and the like. How safe is that? What about killing fish parasites? Look it. And he says, it seems to me the availability of low-temp equipment is far outpacing the consumer understanding and capability. If there is really a serious danger associated with low-temperature and sous vide cooking, as I have heard repeatedly, then I would say there would be a whole lot of illness arising from this technique at home in the coming years. Best regards, Ken. Look, this is complicated, and part of the fact is that we're never going to come out and tell – no one is going to come out and say with a relatively new thing something that, you know, might get someone sick, even though we all know that people get sick from cooking all of the time. So next time when I get back, I'm going to just have Stas and I, maybe, if she wants to. She won't. She doesn't want to. We'll just have like a discussion. Maybe we can get someone on. I don't know. Let's see if we can get someone on. Yeah. And we'll just hash out the food safety stuff. My opinion as a cook versus someone who's more, you know, into food safety, their opinion as a food safety expert. Because we're coming from different points of view. We have different acceptable levels of risk. And the acceptable level of risk, typically in pasteurization levels, is one of supermarket morons walking home with a product in an abused situation, not as someone who's like cooking for their own use at home, who has more control over their raw ingredients. So I think like there are different standards of risk, different standards of what we think the inputs into the cooking are, and those are leading to a lot of confusion. But maybe we can get someone on next week and hash it out. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right. Mm-hmm. Nice. All right. We'll try and get them, and that'll be next week on The Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.